Want an easy way to stay up to date with the latest news and trends in the NBA? Listen to the NBA Daily Ding podcast Monday through Friday. Wake up and turn up the NBA Daily Ding to stay informed on all things NBA here at The Athletic and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Athletic NBA Show, Monday through Friday
on The Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to tampering.
For this beautiful game of basketball that we all love and talk about every single day.
With Sam Panic.
To be able to bring people together.
What do you do, baby?
Reportedly at the center of an NBA investigation
into tampering accusations.
And the message to executives in the league is
stop talking about players on other teams.
What did I do?
The charges filed.
Impermissible contact.
Right or wrong?
Tampering charges are really difficult to prove.
You know me, I talk.
Kind of awkward to even talk about it. I can't even mention teams anymore.
Ask me what I like to play with Kevin Durant.
Trial you want with tampering.
They're always ahead of the rules.
It's not rocket science.
Everybody, I've tampered with the guys.
I didn't tamper. I'm just telling you what happened. I'm just telling you what happened.
Hello and welcome to the Tampering Podcast, part of the Athletic NBA Show Network. I'm Sam Amick, national reporter at The Athletic here as always. We got the same guys, so that part of the programming hasn't changed, but we have like distinct changes to the titles here. Fred Katz is always a Washington Wizards beat writer. Now he's a Washington Wizards playoff beat writer. This is not something that you've experienced, Fred, on this team and this beat. What is up, my guy?
That's not even a title that exists.
It is, because I said so.
It's not even
so,
a thing that we knew Fred, happened in the universe.
I said so, and it is. And your team, we'll get into it later. Your team kind of jacked up the weekend because upset specials all over the place. But I would love to have been talking about a Wizards upset over Philly in game one. That didn't happen. On the other side of the country, we have one Anthony Slater, typically coming to you as a Golden State Warriors beat writer, occasionally would helicopter in on
lottery
the Lakers
team.
Beat. Yeah, lottery team.
They're a lottery team. Second straight season.
Too soon, Slater. Don't be kicking them when they're down. Let the wounds heal a little bit, you know. But now
This is the time to kick him. I don't know what you're talking about.
I see how you roll. Now we got Slater jumping in, at least temporarily, on the Suns beat. The other night, game one goes to Phoenix. We'll get into all that, all kinds of dramatics. But Slater ended up writing about DeAndre Ayton and Devin Booker and the young fellas who had absolutely zero playoff experience doing their thing. Guys, as you know, we're going to make the rounds talking about the action. The only two series that are off limits for this podcast today are Bucks Heat and Blazers Nuggets. They're going to play tonight, so we're recording on Monday morning. But there's plenty to get into beyond that. And the thing is, that's just bonkers, is, you know, you look at this bracket, and, you know, I don't have the historical context at my fingertips, unfortunately, but I guarantee you this is on the short list of, you know, game one, first round, you know, lower seed winning type of games. You got the Grizzlies taking out the Jazz. You got the Mavs beating the Clippers. The Blazers over the Nuggets. The Suns over, that's the top seed. Sorry.
Well, that's the funny thing is, one of the top seeds that won was the one that
fair.
Was the underdog.
Yeah, that is fair. So that kind of did a number on the way you think about it. I'm wrong on that front. But, you know, the Hawks with Trae Young, ice cold Trae Young, just absolutely becoming a villain in the Garden, which was pretty epic in that game. You know, and then the Nets and Celtics went as expected. But fun weekend, lots of action. What jumped out to you guys?
One of the first things I want to say, because I was somewhat laughed by Sam Amick, a couple weeks ago when I mentioned the idea that, like, hey,
hard.
We should.
I'm going to kick you out of this Zoom room.
You better do it quick. No, I was like, you know, home court advantage might matter in these playoffs. Oh, yeah, you know, remember who's at home and the fans. And Sam was like, this guy's really on a fan kick over here. What did you guys think of the fans this weekend?
Yeah, yeah.
That changed things.
It did.
Like New York, obviously. But, you know, I watched that Phoenix game. Like, that was particularly with the Laker fan infusion, because it's down in Phoenix. Like, these were really good crowds. And that's going to, you know, pretty much every arena had a really good crowd.
Yeah, New York was outrageous. Right. Philly seemed bonkers. I was not at the game, but Philly seemed crazy. The MSG crowd was absolutely wild. I mean, yeah.
They won the weekend.
Yeah.
They won the weekend.
Whenever
they
you have. They lost the game.
Doesn't matter. Whenever you have Tracy Morgan doing the, what's it called? The cabbage patch?
Sour, cabbage patch kid?
Yeah. You have Tracy Morgan doing that on a TV cutaway.
With the mask
it doesn't
on
matter.
His chin, like a chin strap.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't matter. That's all I'm trying to see in
I
that
I thought
moment.
Spike Lee was going to tear an Achilles. Jumping.
Spike Lee memes. Yeah. Yeah. It is just a reminder of what we missed in the bubble. And we knew it at the time, and we were talking about, yeah, it's kind of stale. And Sam, I know you were there, so maybe you have a
somewhat
different
perspective. Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, you had
you're like, it was great. I had intimate looks at these
Rajon Rondo's brother talking trash with Westbrook, you know, all kinds of fun stuff.
From a viewer experience, yeah. This is so much different.
It is.
And so much better.
And you, and I'm taking this from just people who were at the games and seeing tweets, but I will take reporter's word for it that you saw a flood of tweets that indicated that this wasn't propaganda, this wasn't, you know, league hype in terms of the decibel level, that it seems like there's this interesting human component where apparently if you put 10,000 people inside a building that can hold 17,000, those 10,000, you know, kind of become unified in some way and just get louder because everybody seemed to be struck by how intense the crowds were.
Yeah, one thing, I went to a game with a crowd because I was at the Friday night play-in game, basically the lead-in to the playoffs, that Warriors-Grizzlies game, and Chase Center really opened up a lot more than they had. I think there were 7,500, and they crunched them on one side of the arena and all these vaccinated sections, and the other side was the more spaced out, I guess, if you felt more comfortable on that side. But it wasn't just the fact that, you know, what you're saying is right, where it's like, hey, we're supposed to carry it over here. But, you know, this amount of fans is let in. Let's carry the noise. But it's also obviously the fact there's a lot of stakes on the line. And you could just, I don't know, you just get the feeling people are like, this is so new. And like, there's such an appreciation. It's what I think what we said a lot during the pandemic was, which was, when the world feels normal again, do you know how much more we're going to appreciate the world being normal? When was the last time I was at a arena with 7,500 people, like, oh wow, there are so exactly. many people here right now, you know. It was like, and it was, you know, I was sitting near Kawakami, he's like, wow, a live national anthem. I haven't heard a live national anthem in so long. And it was just, yeah, I mean, couldn't you just, even on the faces of people, like, I felt like, yeah, of course the Knicks fans were like, oh wow, this is so great, the Knicks are in the playoffs, it's been so long. But it also just felt like, oh wow, we're all like congregating in public and like,
oh, yeah,
celebrating.
I was watching games at home, and my wife and one of my sons looked at the TV and made a comment about, like, are those real people or are those the cardboard cutouts? I was like, those are real people. It was the Utah game, and they're letting a lot of people in. And he had like pandemic PTSD looking at that TV screen, like, wait, what is going on in that place? So we're getting used to it. I do you guys remember which game, I should know this, but which game Mark Jones called? Did he have Knicks?
Yeah.
I think, okay, and I hopefully I remember this accurately because I don't want to be.
No, Knicks was on TNT. I think Mark Jones had the, no, I think he had Lakers Suns. I was watching.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I think
Mark
you're
Jones
right.
And Mark Jackson.
Oh, you
Lakers
are right.
Suns. Yeah.
Bottom line, yeah.
We can edit it out. So yes. So everybody thinks I know my Mark Jones history.
See, but the early part of the telecast, he highlighted the size of the crowd, and if I read him correctly, heard him correctly, there was this funny little moment of transparency, I think unintended, where he said the size of the audience, and then it's almost one of those moments where you don't know that what you were thinking you said out loud. And he was like, oh, 10,000 people, whatever it was. And he's like, okay. Like a little uncomfortable, like, this is, we're doing this. And then quickly corrected himself and was like, all right, we're doing this. This is how it is. But
it did feel quick, which is, I'm cool with, particularly because of the vaccination aspect of all of this. But it did feel like, we were very spaced out like a week ago. Now suddenly it's like, oh, everyone's just got packed playoff.
Listen,
crowd.
I mean, look, this is we talk about Utah having a bunch of fans. The Knicks had 15,000.
Yeah.
And like New York, it feels like New York just opened up overnight. Like,
well, and this is not,
it's very different.
It's not a media podcast, so I'm not going to go too far down this road, but I'm also, we share our own experiences. I'm not going to lie. It was a mixed emotions weekend because I'm watching the crowds and you know, there is a very high level of angst in our media corps about the fact that on the writer's side, we're still not being granted any in-person access. And so to see the amount of people and to see Spike Lee chilling with Julius Randle talking about things, you know, I do look forward to the day when when we are a part of the ecosystem again. But, you know, even coming through the TV screen, this was an incredible weekend. So let's start, because Slater had focused on it. I know the previous pod on the Athletic NBA Show Network had dived in on Lakers Suns, but from the Lakers standpoint, Slater, this Phoenix team comes out and shows that all the questions about playoff experience, all the questions about, you know, the Lakers and whether or not once they got whole again with LeBron and AD, if they could just flip that switch and be the champions, that, you know, at least for a night, they got somewhat answered. And we had theatrics with LeBron going down and Chris Paul going down. And you know, I...
Theatrics is the correct
term.
It is.
I know. And I hate... I'm not ever the dude... Listen, I learned the hard way early in my career. Like, we're not doctors. We're not former NBA players. It's don't get on your high horse too easily or too willingly to question medical stuff. So I'm not doing that. But I do love the fact that LeBron and Chris are extremely good friends. And in another life, they are thespians, because, you know, the way with which they both handled their injuries was very over the top. And even LeBron coming to help Chris and all the, everything that went down, but it was fun to watch. And the Suns pull it out, and Devin Booker is a beast, and Ayton had an amazing game, and the Lakers are in trouble. What'd you see out of the Suns?
Well, so I covered the Lakers in the bubble last year, and they lost game one to Portland. Yeah. They lost game one to Houston. But this felt a little bit different. And, you know, you mentioned the Lakers side of it. It feels different because, you know, LeBron just looks rusty and maybe not all the way there physically. Davis has really been floating in and out and has his same issues. The Lakers just don't look as good. But also, like, that didn't feel fluky from the Phoenix side. You know, like, Devin Booker's that player.
Yeah, man.
And Devin Booker, you know, hasn't been able to show that on the playoff stage. He'd played 409 regular season games before yesterday, which was his first playoff game. But he's like, you know, this isn't an overnight growth to this level of player. It's honestly, I wrote about it in the thing I wrote, but this is why that Chris Paul MVP, like, you know, train was always, you know, unrealistic. Yeah. He's not the best player on the Suns. Right. I mean, Devin Booker, you saw it yesterday, 34 points, 8 assists, the passing. I don't know, you know, for somebody who watches Devin Booker, you know, a little bit more casually, or sometimes I'm on the opponent side, you know, watching, yeah, the Booker's really kind of getting to them in the mid-range, hitting the threes, getting to the rim in transition, that type of stuff. You think of him as a scorer. His signature NBA performance is 70 points in a loss in Boston, that weird game he had a couple years ago. You think of him as a scorer. Right. He was passing yesterday. Right. He and the Lakers were doubling him, and he was so smart with his decisions. He had some turnovers here and there. He's getting a little risky, but I mean, he can. He looked like the next level of wing. You know, he looked like he could be ascending towards like top 10, top 12 type player, leader of a contender, of a conference finalist. And they're the two seed, and you know, they got unfortunate. We thought to get locked up with the Lakers, but the fact that he's doing that, looking like, okay, you're a 1A on a conference finalist, and Ayton looked like he did in the interior, playing his role. And then obviously, like, they didn't really need Chris Paul in that game. Chris Paul didn't have a good game.
I'm not with you on that at all, to be honest with you. Because from a...
I don't mean he did...
No, I just... if he, you know, this is a what-if scenario, but if he doesn't come back, you don't know what that does to the morale of the group. And it did seem, and Monty Williams talked about this post game. Monty actually, Slater, I saw you talking to Devin and Chris. Did you jump on Monty's? I think you were on there, right?
Yeah, I was on Monty's. I asked him about Devin's past.
That's right, yeah. And so, and Monty, you know, with all that history he has with Chris going back to New Orleans, he talked about the element of morale and spirit and what it did to the group when Chris came back, and even admitted that he got a little bit emotional seeing kind of Chris's grit in that moment. So that to me is a Suns team that without Chris Paul is now dealing with Jay Crowder being the only one with any playoff experience of any substance, having to pull off this game one upset. Again, we're going to call it an upset just because it's the champs. Without Chris, I don't know if they would have gotten the job done as great as Devin is. So I do think it's funny because I just did this long piece looking at playoff histories, and I thought about the irony that this game in Chris Paul's playoff, you know, record book is going to go down as one of his worst and just completely forgettable. And it really wasn't.
And with Booker, with the passing, he was not as good of a passer as he is now when he first came into the league. One of the things that he did, which is pretty amazing, is he had a wrist injury a few years ago in his right wrist, and he used it as an opportunity to concentrate on kind of duality of passing and became so much better at passing from different angles with both hands. He's become so much more of a versatile passer to where he can now facilitate from every angle. It's pretty, I mean, he was their lead ball handler. Remember, until they got Chris Paul, they exclusively had too many point guards or not enough point guards. Right. They never had the correct amount of point guards. And when they didn't have enough point guards. Now they have
the point guard.
Exactly. And when they didn't have enough point guards, they basically had Booker run the point. And that obviously did not help them in the moment at all. But I think there's an argument to be made that if you're going to take the optimist's view, that those were big moments for Devin Booker in becoming a more versatile head of an offense kind of player. And he's excellent. He's great next to Chris Paul, but in moments when Paul is not having a great night, he can take over the offense and really keep the Suns as an elite team.
Yeah, so he averaged about 6 assists the last couple of seasons. Actually was down this season, to your point. Like, he's had less of that playmaking duty. I think he's in like 4.5 or so he averaged. But I just, last thing I'd say, watching it from a Suns perspective down the stretch, I was like, Chris Paul, get the ball to Devin Booker. You know, there was times where Chris Paul had the ball and I was like, get it over to Devin Booker. I know that was it. There are games, and I'm sure there will be games in these playoffs, particularly if the Lakers counterpunch, which we all expect, that just the steadier hand of Chris Paul will be needed at times. But it was just, I mean, so
they
clear
need
to
him
yesterday.
Defensively. Like, and then, yeah, first of all, we don't know what he's going to look like in game two, because the shoulder does seem, I mean, it was serious enough that he was either not shooting or shooting, like I might look if I was
out
there.
He kept losing the ball. Did you say that?
Yeah, I think it's dribbling. I don't know.
Looking at his hand.
There's still an element of mystery around his injury. I don't question at all how real it is, because he seemed to grab it in the kind of way like it was a stinger of some sort when he went down.
And his teammate hit him, which would indicate he wasn't like trying to bait a foul, right?
It was a lot. It was more so just, the both teams, circling over him like it was a wake or something. The whole scene was wild. But they need
can we still throw some love DeAndre Ayton's way?
100%. 100%.
Because man, Slater, you wrote about this a little bit and captured it well, I thought, where he, people constantly will mention that he was part of the Luka draft and he was the number one pick in the Luka draft. But that guy is a damn good player. I mean, he is the length that his, or I should say the leap that his defense has made since his rookie year to where he is legitimately good now and is the back end guy on the number, what are they, six? They were sixth in defensive efficiency this year.
They were 29 as a rookie.
And they have lots of good defenders. I mean, I put Bridges on my all defense team. He's excellent. And Crowder's obviously really good. And Chris Paul and all that. But he is the back end guy there. He's the guy who cleans stuff up. I thought he was awesome on AD, just keeping AD away from the paint.
Yeah.
Like only 3 of Davis's 16 shots were at the rim. I just thought he did a really, really excellent job. I think Anthony Davis shot 2 for 9 on possessions that, when he shot when Ayton was the closest defender. He did a great job forcing him into difficult shots, all jump shots. He, on top of the fact that he was 10 for 11 from the field, he's just become an extremely, extremely good player, and his game has gotten so refined. He's still young as hell.
Yeah,
he's gonna be an all-star.
Well, he's played really catch good. Up real quick when it comes to the narrative around his career, because you had the baggage early on that comes with not being Luka, and other players have gone through that as well. Marvin Bagley more than anybody in Sacramento. But then you had the suspension that was a big deal. I mean, he missed a huge chunk of last year because of the substance violation, and so we came to look at DeAndre early on as somebody who was falling well short of expectations. Now you got Mark Jackson on a national telecast telling the world that Ayton was the best big man on the floor when he played against Anthony Davis. So he's been great. You do wonder, I know we're not going to go too Lakers heavy, but like you said, Slater, the Lakers are going to counterpunch. AD and his inconsistency is something that, we've seen before. I read Bill Plachke of the LA Times hammered him in their paper after that game, talking about, how exhausted he is seeing AD be up and down and up and down. So We'll see what happens there. Let's jump over, though, to the other LA series. And
can I say one thing about Davis quick?
Yes, sir.
He was like, he shot mid-rangers like 65% or something like that in the bubble playoffs when we all thought like this guy might be ascending to like best player in the league. He's not historically ever been as nearly that efficient as a mid-range jump shooter, or you know, he shot the three at like 40% or something like that in the bubble. If he doesn't like last night, I mean, Fred mentioned it, it was a lot of mid-rangers. If he's not hitting them in an efficient clip, Lakers are in trouble. Because he clearly wants to take him. And he hit him last year, and I think sometimes we skated over that fact. Like, well, this is AD now. He's basically Kevin Durant from the mid-range, because that's how he shot in the playoffs. If he's not KD in the mid-range, I think they're in trouble. Go ahead. Clippers series. I want some Sam Hot Clippers takes.
Discover the latest collections from David Yurman, as seen recently, styled on basketball stars like Jaime Jaquez, Jalen Green, D'Angelo Russell, and others. David Yurman is a celebrated American jewelry company inspired by the beauty of art, architecture, and the natural world. The story of David Yurman begins in New York City with David, a sculptor, and his wife Sybil, a painter and ceramicist. When the artists began collaborating, their goal was to simply make beautiful designed objects to wear. Over 40 years later, the Yurmans and their son, Evan, continue to redefine American luxury jewelry with timeless, modern collections for women and men defined by inspiration, innovation, consummate craftsmanship, and Cable, the brand's artistic signature. David Yurman's collections are available on davidyurman.com.
I am admittedly distracted by something that just came across my desk. ESPN's reporting that Donovan Mitchell is upset with the Jazz for not playing him in game one. So
he sent out a cryptic tweet last night.
Yeah, he said something like, I wish I could say something.
Well, it wasn't even just him. Did you like the Rudy Gobert came out and was like, you know, it's tough to wake up from your nap to realize that your star player is not playing, but you're going to have to ask him and the medical team about that or something like that. And Bogdanovich said the same thing. He's like, I don't know, something with him and the medical team. You need to ask them about that.
Yeah, I don't know. Donovan Mitchell tweeted last night. He said, sorry, y'all. I wish I could say more. I'll be out there soon. Heart emoji, prayer hands.
Well, then let's kind of roll with that. I mean, this Jazz Grizzlies series, listen, I was watching his demeanor, Donovan's sideline last night, and just imagining, I mean, it was a real surprise that he didn't play in game one. So I think most of this stuff is pretty obvious what's happening here. You have an extremely cautious medical team that Donovan doesn't agree with. And it, I mean, now if this ultimately, this series opening loss is the thing that, you know, leads to them dropping the series overall, I mean, that's a major deal. I know we got a long ways to go, but Memphis is fearless. Memphis came out and took it, and the Jazz, for everything they've been through and everything we've talked about with how they persevered and got themselves, you know, to that number one seed, just right out the gate, you've got all this uncomfortableness.
Let's be real. They sat him because they didn't fear Memphis.
Yeah.
You know, it was more like, you know, we could probably get him a couple, you know, because they're not playing again. I don't think till Wednesday. Their thought was probably right. We get him 3 extra days of rest right. And we're probably going to be up 1-0 anyways. Right. I assume that was the thought. Right. But then they got, you know, they got shocked. Do we want to talk about that game at all? I mean, we can go quick to that one since we've mentioned it. But, you know, Morant, who I saw live, you know, rip the Warriors' hearts out, you know, take their season away in Chase Center, which was super impressive. Dylan Brooks had 30 plus and, you know, in that game. And I thought he was unbelievable on Curry in the two Warriors, these big Warriors games they played. That's a really young core that's on the rise. You know, obviously, you know, what's Brooks probably like 23, 24, Morant, super young, Jaren Jackson, who still kind of rusty. Seems like Valasciunas is their big guy. Who's just getting crazy rebounds, but they've been impressive. I still would definitely pick Utah in this series. I assume you guys probably feel the same, but Memphis has shown a lot. And the fact that they're all young, cheap, rookie scale contract guys in that core means we need to start calculating them in. Like when we're talking next season, like what might the West playoff teams be? They're definitely now in the conversation.
They got role players who are contributing too. I mean, Desmond Bane shot the lights out this year as a rookie, and Grayson Allen has become a really, really good contributor too. I mean, They're good. I still think Utah is going to win the series. I mean, if Mitchell is that upset about not playing in game one, I have to imagine he is going to be playing soon, right? And, I mean, look, Utah...
I would say game two.
Utah...
That's a somewhat surprising part of the report that I just skimmed, is that it left some room open for him not playing game two. It said there is hope. I mean, I would be very surprised to see it. And it also mentions an interesting dynamic about how Dwayne Wade, the new minority owner of the Jazz, might have to play a part here in kind of calming tensions with his history of managing injuries. But it's just not... For a team that has been on an emotional roller coaster for a long time now, going back to last March and even beyond, it's not a good way for them to come out the gate. And Slater, you combine that with what you said about them disrespecting the Grizzlies, for lack of a better way of putting it, I think you're playing with fire here, because that Memphis squad, you know, Dylan Brooks, Reggie Miller had a great line during the telecast that I thought was perfect when Dylan was going crazy. He laughed and he said, man, I like players like this. I like a little bit of loco. And Dylan is a little loco. Like, he is out there, you know, punking Steph Curry and saying, you can tweet about me all you want, but guess what? We knocked you out the playoffs. I'm going to put my sunglasses on in my post-game Zoom press conference and have Ja Morant tell the world that I need more respect. And then I'm going to come out here against Mike Conley, my former teammate, and remind him what it was like when we used to practice together.
Him and Clay were like talking to each other during the game. Like, you know, he would go over to the corner near the Warriors bench, like, to start an offensive possession. It's like Morant was bringing it up, and him and Clay would be kind of like barking at
this
each other.
This is how they are.
Like, they seem kind of similar personalities. Sure. You know,
well, you remember when Dylan and Ja went at Andre Iguodala, you know, over the whole trade thing.
Ja, when he got drafted, said his first hater was his dad. They're all about they're all about responding to being disrespected. But you know what? Taylor Jenkins,
they should be. They play
there.
In Memphis. No one does. I mean, it's true. Nobody pays attention to him. Yeah.
And no, but that front office has done a great job putting that roster together. Yeah. Taylor Jenkins has done a great job coaching it. Utah, though, like, everything went wrong for Utah. That's an offense that's predicated on making threes. They shot 12 for 47 from three. All those guys are not going to have off nights again, in all likelihood. Rudy Gobert only played 25 minutes with foul issues. Like, all those things aren't necessarily going to happen. And then obviously Mitchell didn't play. I'm not necessarily worried about Utah, but this is a nice statement win from Memphis. And I think Slater puts it well with, like, watch Memphis in the next couple of years, because they're only getting better.
Well, and this is maybe a reach, but with our 6 degrees of Oklahoma City element that we always have on this pod with you guys in your history, it, you know, it reminds me a little bit of when the Thunder went into LA and Kobe Bryant's Lakers in that first round series. And I think that they took 2 games in that series. It was a 6-game series. And the fearlessness, it could lay the foundation for, you know, bigger and better things to come down the road, where you, for young teams, getting 1 playoff win, getting 2 playoff wins against, you know, kind of all-star level squads is important and meaningful.
It is, and it will be hugely important, you know, for their confidence level and just, like, into the future. Now, I would say the big difference, that, like, Morant, we could see becoming a Westbrook-type player. They do not have a Durant on that roster. So, like, I don't necessarily think that's a rising title contender unless they get, like, a star in there. But, you know, once again, I will be called a Memphis doubter.
Free agency,
you
don't
know how much of a Memphis doubter I was. I taped a pregame Warriors Jazz series preview podcast with Nate Duncan, and that is in the lost files on my phone that I'm showing you right now. So, you know, I've doubted them before. Maybe they will go on to win the title in the next 3 years, but, you know, that to me would be the difference. And you weren't the first person I've heard made that comparison. Like, this is kind of like the young Thunder, and I'm like, they don't have all, you know.
No, I told you it's apples to oranges.
Stars.
All right, let's go from Salt Lake City to previously known as Lob City, and these Clippers. I know Slater's waiting for Amick Clipper hot takes.
is Kawhi maybe gone?
Doing the Arsenio Hall fist pound here? What's happening there?
I'm Tracy Morgan. I'm doing Tracy Morgan dance while you're doing the Clipper hot takes.
Hoop. Man, these Clippers, they kill me. I stayed off them all year. Didn't really write that much about them. I've been definitely somebody who, when I talk about Ty Lue, I say,
okay, credibility, substance. Like, I think Ty's impact has been good. And, but God dang, if they didn't live up to that reputation in the first game, and never more so than the meme worthy moment, you know, Kawhi's dunk over Maxi Kleber with Markieff Morris and Paul George mean mugging Maxi when he's on the ground, you know, and just looking like that same vibe of feeling yourself too early and too often and thinking that you're something that you're not based on what you've accomplished just seems to be this team's the identity and their ethos, at least until they prove us otherwise. But Luka has a great game, but doesn't do anything in the fourth quarter. But his presence obviously had everything to do with Dallas finishing strong and what the Clippers were doing defensively. But this, to me, is not a game one aberration. I could absolutely see the Mavs winning this series.
Dallas played the Clippers well in the regular season. I mean, they
smoked
played
them
really
by 50, as we've talked
beat
about.
Beat them by 50. Yeah.
The Clippers, who are tanking to avoid the Lakers way too far now.
Right. Right.
Taking it into the postseason.
This is a total dad reference, but the dunk with Kawhi and the way that those three guys like were picking on Maxi on the ground reminded me of Lion King when the hyenas are like trying to beat up Simba. And then, you know, eventually Mufasa comes along. I don't know why that crossed my mind and Fred's not reacting. So I guess like that didn't land.
There we go. There,
I know the exact scene you're talking about. I love the Lion King. My takes on the Clippers almost feel too cliche because just when you think that they should be the team to beat in the Western Conference, they kind of just lay a dud. And I didn't think the offense worked particularly well. They, like Utah, just weren't hitting their threes. I mean, they of the nine guys they played in their rotation against Dallas in that first playoff game, seven of them shot basically 40% from three. I think Kawhi was like 39.8. Shot basically 40% from three or better. And one of the two who isn't a 40% shooter from three is Serge Ibaka, who is still a very good shooter. And they weren't making their shots. I thought Dallas defended them pretty well. And Dallas just ends up pulling away. And I was surprised that the Clippers, and maybe I shouldn't be at this point, but I was surprised that the Clippers did not come out with more verve in
juice.
Yeah, especially after the way that they ended their playoff run last year. I just was, maybe I should have been expecting it. Maybe I shouldn't be surprised anymore, but it was surprising to see.
Isn't the idea when they all came together, particularly when Kawhi and Paul George came, wasn't the idea of the Clippers that like they are maybe the best playoff defense ever, like you would think, right? Two just all NBA defensive wings. Now you have Ibaka, who's considered a good big man back there. Beverly is the pest on the ball, and they can go super small. You can put them, one of the Morris twins in there. You have Zubac as a big, like they should be the best defensive team in basketball if they all played up to their standards. Now they have Ty Lue, who is known as a very good defensive coach, particularly in the playoffs. They were, I think, finished ninth as a defense this year. Okay, maybe they're not just taking the regular season that serious from a day-to-day as they didn't last season, I should say, which caught up to them in the playoffs. They have never come together and been the defensive team we all thought the day that Kawhi Leonard and Paul George came together would be. And I think that has to do with a lot of things. Patrick Beverley, to me, is not what he used to be as a point guard defender. Did you see Luka just bump right into him and one layup and then go, "You're too effing small," right in his face? And it's true. He's too small. He's been kind of like in and out, injury prone. I just don't think he does what he used to do back in the Westbrook days, Beverley. And that's, so there's kind of a lower level on the ball defender. Reggie Jackson's not coming off the bench and helping that. And then, to be honest, like, Kawhi Leonard and Paul George, I think, are kind of riding on defensive reputation more than defensive production.
Slater, you know how with the Warriors, how many times have you heard the Steve Kerr quote about Draymond being the heart of the Warriors, right? Like, we've talked about that forever. And now as Steph has grown from a leadership standpoint, nobody questions him in that area. That, to me, is the thing with the Clippers is – who, and I know it's maybe kind of remember the Titans type stuff and maybe corny, but like, who are the Clippers? Who's leading the Clippers? And I think specifically with Kawhi, what we continue to see is that as incredible of a player as he is on both ends of the floor, the longer that he struggles to get back to that championship stage, which is not very long, obviously, we're talking about a couple of years, I'd look at some of his previous accomplishments a little bit differently, none of which is to take anything away from him. But with the Spurs, you know, he was bred and came up, in an environment that was incredibly unique and special with Timmy and Tony and Manu and Pop. And then he was a fantastic addition to that. But he was certainly not the heart of the Spurs. And from a leadership standpoint, had to do nothing. And then in Toronto, the guy who continues to, I think, be overlooked and underrated is Kyle Lowry. And the idea that Kyle had that locker room where it needed to be, and Kyle had them competitively where they needed to be. And with the Clippers, I still think there's a void because pieces have come and go. I think Montrezl Harrell saw himself as the heart of the Clippers and the leader last year, and they bounced him because he wasn't vibing with his teammates. And that is the part to me that come playoff time, you got to have your heads right. And I know it's only one game, but it certainly didn't look like they did.
Spring is the best time to add new challenges to your training just in time for summer and warmer days. I know I'm looking outside right now. Sun's out, birds are chirping. It's time to start getting outside. I know that I like to get outside and play basketball with my kids. And honestly, I need to get into a fitness routine in order to keep up with these guys. And Peloton is there for me. Peloton's varying class lengths were designed with your training plan in mind. Personalize your workout, whether you'd like to add a 10-minute core session at the end of your strength class, or take a 60-minute power zone ride to increase your endurance. Peloton classes are designed to help focus on your needs and goals. Peloton's classes were made to challenge you. There are a variety of classes like boot camps, boxing, full body strength, or marathon training, all created to grow your skills or push you to improve in what you're already excelling in. Peloton's program and instruction push you to be your best. Their expert coaches and nonstop vibes will push you to new levels of strength and endurance, keeping you on your toes while giving you the professional coaching you need. Peloton has everything you need to get you where you're going. Whether you prefer to run indoors, row or ride at home, or strength train at the gym, Peloton has something for you. Get your head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
I could see them going smaller more in game two and the rest of the series, like lineups with Morris at the five, and just really digging into switching every single screen that they can. And you know, if you end up with Morris on Luka, you're in much better shape than if you end up with one of the bigs on Luka. So I could see that being an adjustment. I think that would help their defense a good amount. I wonder if they're going to put Kawhi on the ball more too. Have Kawhi
they already kind of announced he's going to be guarding Luka for one.
I saw Law Murray had something on. Ty Lue was asked why Kawhi hasn't been on Luka more, and he said,
"You're going to get what you're looking
Tuesday
for."
Or something. Yeah. I mean, I would like to see a game where Kawhi Leonard and Paul George basically try to tag team Luka on the defensive end and like are really up in him and come score on a playoff, like two of the best, longest, most agile wings in the league with defensive chops. They're both one's been a defensive player of the year. The other was in the defensive player of the year conversation before. Let's see that. That's, if those are your two wings, you should be the team in the league best equipped to guard Luka Doncic.
Right.
But they just haven't been.
Right. But then offensively, that's the concern, right? And we'll see how it looks in game two. Because offensively, if you're asking them to beat those guys on defense, then they're going to lack the offensive firepower. So, yeah, much of the same on the Clippers side. We'll see if that changes.
Wizards.
Long overdue. Fred, your Wizards. Man, I got so excited. I was watching. I thought they were going to pull it off. They played well. Yeah, I think they played well. And that Sixers length and that Sixers defense, I thought, finally started paying off for them in the end. And Embiid stopped shooting, as many threes late, got in the post a little bit, and just, enough big shots that they kept the Wizards at bay. Bertans was driving me a little crazy, just missing some open looks. And, all in all, though, a team that I thought comported itself well and continued to, the momentum of what has been a pretty surprising story. But you're still down 1-0 in a series that's going to be obviously pretty tough. What'd you see there?
I thought they played pretty well, and I think that's part of the problem. Like, they played pretty well. I didn't think the Sixers played great, and Philly still came out on top. I mean, that's kind of the way that a 1-8 series tends to work. I think Philly, from a size perspective, just completely overmatches them. They start with a 3-guard lineup, and they have Beal and Howell Neto and Russell Westbrook, and all those guys are 6'3 or smaller, and it puts them in a position to where, I mean, Rui Hachimura is not really a wing. He's their closest thing to a wing. Other than him, they just don't have a guy who they played yesterday who can guard big wings. So you have a massive size disadvantage somewhere. They concentrated all their defense on doubling Joel Embiid, which I don't think was the wrong thing to do at all. But because of that, you end up with Ben Simmons going one-on-one against somebody he's 8 inches taller than, or Tobias Harris gets hot against Hachimura and Hachimura's not disrupting him.
What,
and
there's 27 really nothing in the first else. Half?
Yeah, 28. And there's nothing else you can do. There's no one else you can put him on. What are you going to do? Put 6'3 Bradley Beal on Tobias Harris and just let him shoot over him every time when he's that hot? They tried it. He guarded him some possessions. He still made his shots. I mean, there's not really anything they can do in those scenarios. So I think the size advantage really hurts them. Offensively, I thought they played... Westbrook didn't have a good game, but offensively, I thought they played great. They had 78 points in the paint against the team with, you know, the best defensive team in the Eastern Conference, against a team with Tybull and Simmons and Embiid. They took 55 shots in the paint. They clearly made a concerted effort to get there. But defensively, I think the size is actually going to hurt them more defensively, to where they're just really difficult to guard. I wouldn't be shocked if they made personnel adjustments and played some guys who are not as often in their rotation just for matchup reasons. Like, throw Anthony Gill out there. How many listeners of the podcast know who Anthony Gill is?
I was going
to
say, who?
Yeah. A great name. R&B singer in the 80s. Yeah.
Yeah. Throw Anthony Gill out there.
This would have been a good series for Avija to, like, just learn this type of game. It's tough for them that he had that.
Well, he's important for them. He's important for them because he's just a human being who is 6'9" and lanky, and they don't have those. They just don't have
them. And a lottery pick who, you know, could be solid and would love to learn in this environment and play these big wings and feel that size. The one thing I'd say, and I, you know, just watching the game, it just is going to be a bad series for Russell Westbrook. That, you know, because he's so stubborn about getting to his spots and going through, and no defense can stop me. But how many times was it like, you know, he's doing a spin and Tobias Harris long arms coming over and ripping it, or Ben Simmons is standing him up. So then he's throwing a pass to the ref, by the way, because they're wearing jerseys that look like the ref jerseys. But it just, to me, feels like it's going to be a high turnover series, low efficiency series for Westbrook. And I mean, this is what Philly should do, though, right? I mean, this is a dominant one seed that needs to show how dominant they are.
Yep, agreed. To that point, Slater, unless you guys see otherwise, I'm going to skip over the Nets-Celtics, which is somewhat of a one-sided opening affair. I mean, Boston pushed pretty well, and then the Nets pulled away later on, but I just can't wait to get to Knicks-Hawks. We had some fun off the air.
I love that series. That's my favorite first-round series.
It's amazing. I mean, it's the Garden, and you see, it's funny, you know, even reporters who are typically, you know, not talking much about the environments and things off the court. Like, Mark Spears tweeted out from ESPN, tweeted out a picture of the Garden, but from the outside. And I don't know if Mark was in New York, but, like, it was a picture of the Garden with, you know, with people flooding into it and with the excitement and the lights, and, you know, playoff basketball was back in the Garden. But man, Trae Young decided that he's going to go into their house and rip their throats out and walk out of there talking trash and telling people that they're pretty quiet. So fun stuff. But what'd you guys see there?
Trae was amazing. That was an incredible playoff debut, I thought. And I thought he was on that final play when he hit the game winning floater. He was so composed in that moment. You know, Taj Gibson comes over off of John Collins to double team him, and he just goes right, anticipates the double team, drives past Nil Aquino, who came in specifically to cover him on that play, drives past Nil Aquino before the double team can even get there. And that floater is so dangerous, ends up making it over Julius Randle. I thought it was such a composed play when a lot of guys who are good jump shooters in those situations feel like, all right, I'm going to wind down the clock and then I'm going to pull up. And I thought he went into that with a plan and it worked, and he waved off Collins so he could take over that possession. He was so composed that whole game. I thought he facilitated wonderfully. That was a huge moment for him. It felt like that was
my
a huge
favorite
moment.
Part, favorite with quotations around it a little bit, was that not only does the guy come out and have an incredible playoff debut that puts him, by the way, I think 30-10, it was Jordan, LeBron, and I'm forgetting one other person who had a playoff debut of that ilk. So Trey in rarefied air. And then he jumps on social media to slip in, "Hey everybody, just so you know, I also just launched a signature shoe." You know, he was out there selling kicks.
It's good marketing.
It is.
From the Knicks side, Julius Randle went 6 of 23 shooting. He's their guy, and this was their game that he had kind of powered them to home court in the first round at a packed Garden, and he just had a really bad game. I don't know, Fred, why did he have a bad game? I didn't watch the game that closely because it was after Lakers Suns. I was writing. It was kind of on in the background. I saw the Trey moment, but I just know Randle struggled. I don't really know why he struggled.
He didn't do a good job, guys. And when I say not a good job, I mean by Julius Randle standards, that dude barrels himself to the rim. He took 11 mid-range. He took 11 non-paint twos. Like, that's not the number that you want him doing. And I think that's a little bit of the Clint Capella influence low. Yeah. Capella has been great all year for them. I mean, they're like 10 points per 100 possessions better on defense when he's on the floor this year. I mean, they're a completely different defense when he plays. But I thought that was a big part of it. I from a Knicks offense perspective, they didn't seem like they took advantage of Trae Young matchups as much as they could. Like, I wonder if they're going to try to throw Trae Young in more pick and roll in that game. He was guarding RJ for a lot of the fourth quarter, and you didn't see RJ really go at him all that much. And I think Barrett has become a really good, capable player who's capable of exploiting a matchup like that. So, I didn't think their offensive process was amazing. Although Alec Burks gets the
27. Yeah. Former Warrior. I covered him last year.
He was great.
He was really good.
He was great. That was
27.
I love that series though, because it's two teams who I think are really even and have completely opposite identities. And you got like the Hawks who are more of like a flashy Trae Young team, who have a lot of scorers and a lot of ball handlers. And I think both teams are very well coached. And then you got the Knicks, who are just going to tough you out, and they're going to make the game ugly, and they're going to just turn it into a slog. And both of those teams are really fun to watch for exact opposite reasons. I thought it was going to go 7 going into it, and I definitely still think it's going to be a super close series the whole way.
It is the year 2021, and Tom Thibodeau just played Derrick Rose 38 minutes in a playoff
with good
game.
Reason, by the
off
way.
Off the bench.
With very good reason.
Off the bench.
Making me feel good about minutes. my
Well, he had Rose. A quick trigger with Elfrid Payton in that game.
Elfrid Payton, the starter, 8 minutes.
Yeah, well, he
Elfrid
pulled
Payton
quick.
Played 8 minutes.
Making me feel good night. About my just, Derrick Rose third in the sixth man of the year vote that I cast last week. He's a difference maker for them. The Randle thing you guys hit on, I just question if the Knicks have enough offensive firepower, because this Hawks team has got a unique ability to night in, night out, essentially have a rotating cast of 4 or 5 scorers where, you know, If Bogdanovich doesn't have it, then you go to Gallinari. If Gallinari doesn't have it, let's go over Lou Williams a little bit. You know, Trey is the steady one and John Collins. And that's the thing. I mean, Bogdanovich hitting that three late, which, by the way, this game could have flipped the other way because that was a broken play almost, where, you know, he barely got his hands on the ball, buries that three. That was a game changer. But they just, the depth offensively and the way that Nate McMillan is using those guys is the thing that, you know, is going to keep Tom Thibodeau up at night for these next few nights, and I'm curious to see what adjustments they end up making defensively.
Yeah, and the Hawks, I mean, you look down the list and there are a lot of Hawks players who could have done more. How about Sweet Lou? Trey was awesome, but yeah, Trey was awesome. Lou Williams was killer. And I mean, he didn't even play that much and he made his impact felt, but Gallinari didn't do much. And, you know, DeAndre Hunter didn't do a ton and he's still kind of getting his footing back after missing so much time. And John Collins, it's not like, you know, he had some sort of massive game. So I think there's room for improvement on,
they're just deep,
on the
though.
Atlanta side. They're so deep. That was what we talked about, I think, on the first episode that we recorded together in this iteration of this podcast. Do the Hawks have too many guys?
Right.
I remember having that conversation and no, they have the right amount of guys.
I like it. All right, guys. I think we covered the entire gamut here. Here's to more Spike Lee dancing and we'll see what happens in the next iteration of the first round. But appreciate you guys. Thank you as always for jumping on.